So you'd have a 120-day session, but you'd have bookends of 45 days in both ends and maybe a 30-day period in between.
Lawmakers consider new ideas for legislative sessions. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 21st of April. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, bacterial disease delays a hatchery opening in Sitka.
There can be some pretty high mortality rates with that particular disease if you're not careful.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Support for APRN comes from the Doyon family of companies working together to build Alaska's future.
When the legislature adjourned Sunday night with no special session in sight, lawmakers had a chance to look back on the first year they have met the voters' instructions to complete their work in 90 days. But during the past 2 years, complaints about the new time limit have arisen, enough so that the Legislative Council has been instructed to analyze the new law so changes could be considered next year if necessary. Dillingham Democrat Bryce Edgman is on the House subcommittee that will look at the issue. He says their instructions are open-ended.
You know, my informal observation is that there seems to be a large amount of support both in the legislature and also for those that work outside the legislature to return back to the 120-day session.
Members are circulating suggestions on new formats. As an example, one would limit lawmakers to 90 days in formal capital meetings, but with extra time inserted to visit constituents or to hold remote community meetings.
And so you'd have a 120-day session, but you'd have bookends of 45 days in both ends and maybe a 30-day period in between. That's one concept that we're looking at as well, but, it really is a blank slate at this point.
The House and Senate subcommittees will each report to the Legislative Council, where Chairman John Harris says he'll give final suggestions to the entire legislature before the start of next year's session. He says they're not limited to yes or no on continuing the shorter session.
Or it could be sort of a in-between that says we think that certain things need to happen. Maybe legislation needs to be able to be moved during the interim, or committees need to be able, have certain authority, or, a number of things that need to come forward from this committee or should come forward, maybe changing the way you do business.
Harris says nothing will stop any individual legislator from presenting a bill, and there is no requirement for the Legislative Council to try to make statutory changes next year. A $45 million state office building for downtown Juneau is now a capital city priority for next year's legislative session, and Juneau's new senator says he's ready to carry it through the Senate. A measure to allow the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority to construct the facility at the subport remained in Senate Finance Committee at adjournment Sunday. The 147,000-square-foot building is a city and borough priority, but the idea came from the Palin administration, which needs to find alternative spaces for more than 500 state employees in the Departments of Public Safety, Fish and Game, and Labor. The Mental Health Trust Authority owns the subport land. The proposal calls for the trust to develop the office space and lease it to the state. House Bill 161 would give the trust access to $22.7 million of its revenue, which is managed by the Permanent Fund Corporation. The bill also allows the state to issue bonds for the same amount to finance the facility. The legislation had 7 hearings in the House. It arrived in Senate Finance just 10 days before adjournment. Chairman Bert Stedman says the project and the policy it would set is too big to push through at the end of session.
There's concerns of the size and scope of the policy call for the construction of it, and we're going to most likely bring it up in the early part of the next session to work on.
Juneau's seat on the Senate Finance Committee was empty for the last 49 days of the session, but Stedman says a senator would not have been able to move the project along. When it comes up next session, newly appointed Senator Dennis Egan will have to steer it through the Senate. But subport redevelopment has been a hot topic for a long time. After 5 years as mayor and 11 on the Assembly, Egan's ready to take it on.
We've been fighting over that land for years. I'm thoroughly familiar with the situation, and I hate to let it wait till next year because it puts the kibosh on some of the private leases that are out there.
The Labor Building lease expires in 2012. The poorly constructed facility has given the state a headache for years. Had the legislation passed, the project would have been underway by 2010 and the facility ready for occupancy in 2012. Two lost seal hunters were found after spending a night on ice floes. A search and rescue team from the village of Newtok located the stranded men. KYUK's Shane Iverson reports.
Jacob Dubichluk Jr. of Nunapichuk and Roman Carl of Newtok are safe and sound after becoming disoriented and running out of gas. The two were hunting in Hazen Bay, north of Nelson Island in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. A search began after they were reported overdue Sunday night. Alaska State Troopers, Civil Air Patrol, and volunteer search and rescue teams participated in the search. Tom John of Newtok was part of the volunteer team. On Monday afternoon, John says his team heard two gunshots. They followed the sound with their binoculars and were able to see the lost hunters. Dubichluk and Carl spent the night drifting in ice after they became disoriented and ran out of gas. They were about 5 miles away from where they had parked their snow machines. John says the two had caught about four harbor seals. They used seal blubber to make a fire when the temperature dropped at nighttime. The two were in good shape when they were found. John also says steady sunlight is hastening breakup along the coast. I'm Shane Iverson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, celebrating gray whales in Kodiak.
For well over 800 years, the people here on Kodiak Island have utilized whales in a respectful way.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska. BP, where training Alaska's future workforce is a priority. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
Because of the economy, some Alaskans may be receiving letters and phone calls from debt collectors. As KSKA's Len Anderson reports, too often the people receiving the notices don't know their legal rights.
Jim Davis is an attorney with the Northern Justice Project and a pro bono volunteer for Alaska Legal Services. Davis's specialty is debtors' rights. He makes clear that does not mean debt avoidance.
If you or I owed a debt and we didn't pay it and the bank started writing to us, we'd owe the debt. And we can try to make payments, and we should try to make payments. I mean, I think we all agree on that.
But, Davis says, sometimes debt collectors overstep ethical and legal boundaries.
If you're a surviving son or daughter of a mother or father who passed away, those debts expire when your mom or dad passes away. If you want to, as a moral thing, you certainly can, but the law says you don't have to pay those debts. Similarly, if your husband or wife dies, you don't have an obligation to pay those debts either.
That's a legal point often ignored.
Debt collectors never acknowledge that. Debt collectors will go to you. I've just seen letters this past week where they will write to the surviving spouse or the surviving son saying, condolences, your mother passed away. You owe us $5,000.
Another bit of legal overstepping involves expiration.
Sometimes debt collectors seek to collect debts that are time barred. That is, that they're so old that the debt collector has no right to collect those debts, but tries to do so anyways.
That time limit varies. In the case of credit cards, it depends on which state the card was issued and when was the last payment made. The debt limit can range from 3 to 6 years. Davis cites a case involving an 8-year-old debt.
When we finally found out about the case and started helping the lady who had this lawsuit filed against her, ultimately, we got the debt forgiven, we got her money returned, and we got them to pay her compensation, the thousands of dollars for doing that to her.
Another illegal action involves debt collectors who seize protected money.
The other outrageous thing, and I see this is like a weekly occurrence, somebody with completely exempt monies, completely protected monies, an elder on Social Security, a disabled person receiving disability payments, has those completely protected monies seized by a debt collector and not returned ever or for months, even though it was completely exempt as a matter of federal or state law.
Getting illegally seized money returned is good, but blocking the improper seizure before it happens is better. The key to prevention is not to ignore collection letters or lawsuit notices. Because we Alaskans receive permanent fund checks, we are never considered completely judgment-proof. Judgment-proof is a legal term meaning that the individual will never have any money available to pay a debt. Normally, the notified debtor has 20 days to respond to pending judgment. Davis describes a case where an Anchorage credit union raided the account of someone who had lost her job. The creditor went after the family's PFD money.
A woman in Bethel who owed a $2,000 judgment had her bank account swept by a local credit union where they seized over $10,000 in her funds and kept that $10,000 for a number of months, even though they were only owed $2,000.
Davis also recommends when contacted by an unfamiliar outside collection firm about a debt, immediately ask for written verification. Under federal law, the agency has to provide information that you do indeed owe the money and the debt is still valid. Many debt collectors based outside Alaska cannot do so. They simply bought the debt as part of a big package of loans in arrears offered by a lending institution for 2 to 10 cents on the dollar. In purchases involving thousands of loans, very often the supporting information is not supplied. If the agency does not have the legally required information, Davis says the collection effort should stop. But be prepared. In all likelihood, that agency will sell the debt to someone else. Deal with the new collector in the same quick fashion. Davis recommends two places to seek help within the state, Alaska Legal Services and Consumer Credit Counseling of Alaska. One can also check the websites of the National Consumer Law Center and the National Association of Consumer Advocates. This is Len Anderson.
Alaskans are advised to be wary heading into the mountains as the weather continues to warm. That warning follows this past weekend's deadly avalanche in the mountains near Valdez. Jordan Williams of Anchorage was killed in a slide that triggered while he was riding a snow machine up a steep slope in Thompson Pass. State Department of Transportation avalanche forecaster Peter Carter in Valdez says avalanche danger always increases in the spring.
This time of year is classic avalanche season, particularly here in the northern latitudes where the sun travels longer in the sky and puts a lot of heat into the snowpack. So at this time of year, we have what we commonly call the spring shed, and the snowpack starts peeling off.
Carter says people can trigger a weakening snow layer to slide by traveling over it. Carter is part of a group, Alaskasnow.org, which posts avalanche forecasts. Longtime Valdez area backcountry ski guide Matt Kinney, who also posts snow and avalanche information online, says people need to ask some basic questions when heading into the mountains.
Number one question is, are natural avalanches occurring? That's the mountain screaming at you. And the other thing is the slope that you're traveling on, is it capable of sliding? That's generally anything over 30 degrees is capable of sliding. And then after that is, can it slide? And the only way to understand whether or not it can slide or not is probably taking an awareness class.
Kinney and Carter both emphasize the importance of educating yourself about snow and avalanche risk assessment. They also recommend having and knowing how to use snow safety and rescue equipment, including avalanche beacons. The gray whales have returned to Alaska waters. Kodiak has a festival every year to welcome the grays as they swim by on their journey from Baja California to the Bering and Chukchi Seas. Actually, some of them never leave. Eric Wander reports from member station KMXT.
The annual festival opened last week with a talk at the Aleutic Museum on the history of marine mammal hunting. Several events for children and families were held over the weekend, including a harbor walking tour, whale watching at Narrow Cape, and a large squid dissection demonstration. Aleutic Museum Executive Director Sven Haugensen said Whale Fest welcomes back the whales while promoting awareness of the traditional importance of whales to the inhabitants of Kodiak.
It's bringing an awareness of the traditional knowledge of whale hunting and whale use, and also, you know, utilizing whales for food. There's been a huge stigma of, oh, no, it's bad to eat whale, bad to eat whale. Well, for well over 800 years, the people here on Kodiak Island have utilized whales in a respectful way, and it's only been since the 30s that whaling has not only disappeared, but whales have not come back to at least some of the areas around Kodiak.
Volunteer organizer Cheryl Nugent has been involved with the festival since 1998. Nugent has been helping organize the event every year since.
And it just sounded so awesome because I was new to the island and gray whales are really cool, and I was excited about being here and being involved with whales on the island. It was like a dream come true for me.
Nugent said the aim of the festival is to welcome the whales back to Kodiak. She said Kodiak occupies a unique spot along the whale's migratory path from the Baja Peninsula to the Arctic Ocean, which occurs at this time each year. She said people in Kodiak are fortunate to be able to see the whales from land, unlike most other locations in Alaska.
And it's the only place in Alaska where you can actually stand on land and see hundreds of whales go by. And it's a really exciting event, and for thousands of years they've been doing this. And so just seeing them come back every year is such a neat thing. It's the largest migration of any mammal in the world. They go all the way up to the Arctic Ocean, and then they turn around. They eat up there, feed there for the summer, and they turn around, and they go back south all the way down to the Baja Peninsula in Mexico. So it's quite a distance. It's quite a journey. And so this celebration just welcomes them back every year.
Nugent said people have already begun spotting migrating whales, but that full migration is still a week or so away. She also said there is a rogue pod of whales that appears to stay in Kodiak waters all year and not continue on the migration.
The last few years, there's been a pod of gray whales that have decided to stay in Kodiak waters. They don't continue on the migration. They stay here. We call them the resident grays in the Passagshack Bay area. They live here year-round. I guess the food is good enough that it does not, they don't feel the need to go north or go south. They stay here year-round.
I'm Eric Wander.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Grant Station, now offering several webinars each month. More information at grantstation.com.
April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month, and the Department of Defense has launched a program called Our Strength is for Defending. Dr. Kay Whitley is the director of the new Sexual Assault Prevention Office. Whitley says the military had nearly 3,000 reports of sexual assault in 2008. She says they don't know how that number has changed in the past decade.
We haven't been collecting data long enough to even develop trend data. So we, at this point in time, we don't know how it's changed. All we can do at this point in time is to report the number of reports of sexual assaults that we've had.
Our Strength is for Defending. What's meant by that campaign title?
Well, this year what we're doing, we work with an organization called Men Can Stop Rape, and they had a very effective campaign that was called the My Strength campaign that focused on young men ages 18 to 24. And so we took that campaign and adapted it to the military. Of course, we're focusing it on both men and women because we also, as I said earlier, we're using the concept of bystander intervention, so everyone has to be involved. And we're trying to ensure that everyone in the military knows that it's their responsibility to step in and to prevent sexual assaults from occurring.
Women oftentimes say they feel victimized again by the legal system. How are you working to address those concerns so that people feel able and comfortable coming forward to report these crimes?
Well, that is certainly one of the focuses of the Secretary of Defense. He has four priorities. He wanted us to look at how we are investigating and prosecuting this crime. And so we're doing some specialized training for prosecutors and investigators. We know we're not perfect, but we're working on it.
Walk me through the scenario of what happens when someone reports this type of crime, a sexual assault crime, a rape. What happens? Is there an advocate there with them? What's the process in place?
If they report to the hospital will call the sexual assault response coordinator. And that's probably the most important time of the whole event, because that's when the sexual assault response coordinator or the victim advocate will sit with the victim and explain their reporting options. And we do offer a confidential reporting option. If they decide they don't want their command to know and they don't want to undergo the rigors of an investigation, they can choose to report anonymously. They can still get the support from the hospital, any counseling, any follow-up care they need, but it won't be reported to their command, and they won't have to work with the military police in any way or the investigators in any way.
If they choose to stay anonymous, how will the crime be dealt with?
Well, the crime itself, since they will choose not to name their offender and choose to do it anonymously, the crime will not be dealt with at that point in time. But they can choose to go through a sexual assault forensic exam, and we will store the evidence for up to a year. So if they change their mind at any point, I think it's important to know that when you're working with victims of sexual assault, the first thing they feel is a total loss of control. And by giving them this option, it gives them a little bit of that control back. And what happens a lot of times is they go away, they walk away, and once they start feeling the support and seeing that there's a support system in place for them, they will change their mind sometimes and go forward with an unrestricted report so that we can investigate and hold the offender accountable. And we usually, well, like last year, we had over 100 victims change from restricted to unrestricted reporting in the course of that year.
You mentioned that you're the director of this office that's sort of newly created in the last 3 years. Why was the office created? What's happening that you made the decision that this was necessary?
What was needed was an office at the secretary's level that would be the single entry point. And I see our role as getting consistency of excellence across the services so that the program is more standardized and more professionalized. It was kind of an unusual thing to do at the time to have a policy office for a crime. But the secretary became very interested in the topics, especially when he heard that there were some victims of sexual assault in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Dr. Kay Whitley is the director of the Department of Defense Office of Sexual Assault Prevention. Links to more information are at our website, aprn.org. Federal biologists say three pesticides commonly used in agricultural crops threaten the survival of many Pacific salmon and steelhead listed as threatened or endangered in the West. The National Marine Fisheries Service said it is recommending labeling restrictions, buffer zones near salmon waters for ground and aerial spraying, and a ban on the pesticides' use in windy conditions. The service says the pesticides can kill fish, impair fish growth, and reduce its prey. The agency sent its findings to the Environmental Protection Agency, which has a year to draw up new guidelines. The restrictions would apply to pesticide use in Oregon, Idaho, California, and Washington. The findings are the result of lawsuits that anti-pesticide groups and salmon fishermen brought against the EPA and the Fisheries Service. A naturally occurring bacterial infection has delayed the opening of a new coho hatchery in Sitka. The Northern Southeast Regional Aquaculture Association, or NSERA, says efforts to collect broodstock from a lake on southern Baranof Island have been stymied by the high incidence of bacterial kidney disease. From member station KCAW, Robert Woolsey reports.
NSERA General Manager Pete Esquiro announced the news at a recent meeting of the Sitka Economic Development Association. He told members that NSERA was going back to the drawing board at its new $2.5 million hatchery in Sawmill Cove.
After almost 5 years of working at developing an early coho broodstock, and this was from the Whale Bay area, it became very evident to us that that stock was not going to work in Sitka Sound. And so we have had to abandon development of what we call the Plotnikov Lake coho stock. And just last week, we got our permits approved to utilize Salmon Lake Creek stock, which is up in Silver Bay.
The Plotnikoff Lake stock was considered desirable for the new hatchery since they are an unusual summer run of coho and could be targeted independently of wild stocks of silvers, which tend to run in late summer and early autumn. But the Plotnikoff Lake fish proved to have unusually high rates of a disease fairly common in coho, king salmon, and some trout species.
We continue to have problems with a disease called bacterial kidney disease, or BKD.
That's Ensaraz operations manager Lon Garrison. All hatchery fish retained for broodstock are screened for BKD by sending a kidney sample into a pathology lab in Juneau. A 10% infection rate is manageable in a hatchery, over 15%, and the eggs will be discarded. Garrison says that the Plotnikoff stock have been returning numbers all over the map for BKD.
We started out like the first year, it was about 35%. The next year, it dropped down to like 12%. We thought, great, those eggs ought to be pretty good. We're kind of on the right track here. Then the next year, it went back up to like 38 or 40%, and the following year was 40%. And finally, in the fifth year that we tried this, we had a BKD incidence of nearly 75%.
That meant Ensaraz would have to discard three-quarters of its Plotnikoff eggs. In nature, BKD does not present a major threat to fish populations. In the closed confines of a hatchery, where it can pass from parents to their offspring, Garrison says BKD is a deal breaker.
In the wild, while they may carry the disease, it may never really express itself in terms of a lot of mortality. And whereas in an environment such as a hatchery, where you know we have to do it in a much more dense environment, it can really cause us a lot of grief. There can be some pretty high mortality rates with that particular disease if you're not careful.
So Ensaraz this year will collect broodstock for the Sawmill Cove facility at Salmon Lake, just a few miles up Silver Bay near Sitka. Salmon Lake has a wild run of over 2,000 coho each fall. Garrison says they're hardy and well adapted to Sitka Sound. The plan is to collect sufficient eggs from the wild stock to rear and release about 50,000 smolt from the Medvigi hatchery at Bear Cove for each of the next 3 years. Another 200,000 smolt will be released each spring at Deep Inlet. To avoid introducing coho into Sawmill Creek, Ensaraz plans no releases from the Sawmill Cove hatchery site. Pete Esquiro told the Sitka Economic Development Association that Ensaraz had wanted the Salmon Lake stock all along. The two-year delay has been frustrating, but by 2015, Esquiro predicts that the Sawmill Cove site could be producing returns of up to 200,000 coho for trollers on the outer coast and the other common property fisheries. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Shane Iverson in Bethel, Len Anderson in Anchorage, Rosemary Alexander in Juneau, Eric Wander in Kodiak, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. The Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. And by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.